So this is a slideshow on the mandala of the five Buddhas. And it sort of follows on from the series we've been doing on Buddhist symbols. So we started with the stupa. And in a way, this was the first emblem that there was for the Buddha. So in the early days of Buddhism, when people wanted to remember the Buddha after his death, they would tend to go to a stupa. They would tend to go to a burial mound, and there were quite a number of them in India that held some of the ashes of the Buddha himself and other great Buddhist teachers as well. And so that was the first thing that we looked at. And then the next week we looked at a teaching symbol in Buddhism, which was the Tibetan Wheel of Life. So symbolism started to be used in Buddhism as a teaching method, visual images. It's all very well having all these lists and concepts and ideas and teaching, but those visual symbols are really helpful to people so that you can remember, yes, I can remember the six realms. Now it feels as if I'm a bit in the animal realm at the moment, aren't I? Or I'm a bit in the jealous gods realm at the moment. That sort of symbolism. We looked at the Buddha image itself, which turned up rather later in Buddhism, surprisingly. It looks as if, as far as we know, in the early days of Buddhism, they didn't have any statues of the Buddha. And it was a few hundred years before they did. And I think I'll just say something a little bit about that now, because it's relevant to looking at the five Buddhas. Five Buddhas? You know, why five? If you're not very familiar with Buddhism, that might be quite a surprise, because after all, the Buddha was the founder of Buddhism. And then I suppose a Buddha is somebody who's gained enlightenment, but what are the five Buddhas? I mean, these are mythical Buddhas, they're not historical. And it's quite interesting that during the Buddha's own life, people became very, very devoted to him, very attached to him almost, you might say. And he found this a little bit wrong. In a way, he tried to discourage it, and there was one chap, Vakali, for example, who was very ill and couldn't travel to see the Buddha, and was really upset. And the Buddha did go and see him, and he was so pleased to see the Buddha, and he was so devoted, you know, in the old-fashioned Indian way, absolutely intense positive emotional response to his teacher, the Buddha. But the Buddha, almost sort of told him off, and he said, look, this is just a body. This is just a human personality. What is really important is awakening itself. And what you'll find awakening is something which is a universal possibility. And awakening is represented by the Dharma, by the truth, or by the teachings, or by the path, or by reality itself. So what he says is, he who sees the Dharma sees me. That was the phrase that he used. And this became later on taken a little bit further by people who said, in a way, the Buddha has two bodies. The form body, the actual physical body of the Buddha, which was known as the Rupakaya, form body, and the Dharmakaya, the body of truth. So it's as if when you met the Buddha, it was much more valuable to meet the truth than it was to meet a particular person, if you could do so. So this became the Dharmakaya. And then when Buddhist art started, people obviously started trying to sculpt images of and paint images of the Buddha himself as a historical personality. But they also thought, let's see if we can paint pictures of the Dharmakaya as well. How are we going to do this? And Buddhist art sort of emerged almost out of this process. How can we paint pictures of awakening, of enlightenment, not just the historical Buddha? How can we just show pure compassion? How can we show awareness itself, you know? And, you know, some were very successful in doing this, some maybe not so successful. And so this is what happened in the early days of Buddhism, in the first few hundred years. The Dharmakaya started to become important, and people started representing it. And they represented it in human form, usually. But why in human form? It seems to me that if you want to see compassion, then just, you might sort of draw a raindrop or something and say that symbolizes compassion. It might work, you know, in that way. Or even, you know, a nice log fire. You might feel, you know, the warmth of a log fire. Or maybe in this kind of weather, you know, a long, tall, cool drink. That might be a symbol of compassion. But a far more effective way of doing it is a compassionate human face. That really, if you can do it, if you're a good enough artist, if you can see compassion in a human face, that's going to convey it much more strongly, I think. And maybe not just in the face, but in the whole way that the person holds themselves, the gestures that they use, even maybe the way they dress, the way they ornament, the background to the image, all that kind of stuff. So Buddhist art was usually very, very human-centered. It almost went the opposite way to, say, Islamic art, where they said you can't represent God, so we don't have any human figures. It said, no, let's have loads of human figures, the more the merrier, millions and millions of different ones, you know, and it became very rich in depicting human figures. But it also did continue to use other kinds of symbols, and the week after we looked at the Buddha image, we looked at, here's a Buddha image from Java, attempting to convey something of awakening. And if you imagine this, it looks as if the eyes are closed, but they're not actually closed. And if you imagine those eyes were painted in, as they probably would have been originally, so that you can see the Buddha looking out with that very soft, peaceful expression. And then we looked at another Buddhist symbol, the Vajra. That's what we looked at 2 weeks ago. And one of the things I mentioned about the Vajra was that it represents the whole of a new trend in Buddhism. And that new trend in Buddhism is called the Vajra Way, the Vajrayana. And the Vajra Way, the Vajra is the diamond or a thunderbolt, the Vajrayana started to say, and rather than in a way letting go of or leaving behind or dealing with all your problems, what you can do is you can transform them. It was a magical process. So for example, if you experience a lot of jealousy, rather than saying jealousy is a bad thing, you must stop, you're a very naughty person to feel jealous, you'd say, the jealousy is filled with energy, and I can change that. I can use that energy for productive purposes and change the jealousy into something much, much more constructive, much more creative. So rather than squashing it and getting rid of it, you started to find ways, very risky ways actually, because this can go wrong. You might start to think it's really good to be jealous in general, but it is also very, very, very effective. It needs a very good teacher to do this. And this Vajra, in a way, symbolizes the process. The five prongs at one end represent the five poisons, things like jealousy or hatred or lust or ignorance and so on. The five prongs at the other end symbolize the five wisdoms that they can be transformed into. And I mention this particularly because this fivefold division is represented by the five Buddhas. We're going to see this in a minute. We're going to get on to looking at the whole of Vajrayana is filled with, I think, what is called the quincunx in Western philosophy and Western psychology. And the quincunx is the fivefold symbol, like the five dots on a dice, where you have four in the corners and one in the middle. So this becomes a very, very important root of symbolism in Vajrayana. And you can see this here, you've got one prong in the middle and four around the outside. And the same goes for the mandala of the five Buddhas. So that's what we're going to get onto, yeah? So don't worry if this isn't making very much sense yet, because I'm going to come back to it in a minute. So first of all, I wanted to say something about mandalas in general. So a mandala, the literal meaning of manda is just circle. It just is a circle. And in fact, the area around the enlightenment seat was known as the Bodhimanda. And mandala is just an extension of that word, manda. But it became a symbolic circle. And in particular, you place something that is really important to you in the middle, and you'd surround it with significant emblems that were in a symmetrical relationship to it. And by looking at that mandala, it's as if that central thing that's really important to you would become more and more meaningful, where you connect with it better and better, because you'd put things around it that you already had a connection with. So in this case, we've got jewels on the left, we've got a vajra at the bottom, a bell on the right, a flower on the top. So it's as if the blue sky in the middle is what you're saying here is really important. There's that blue sky of pure awareness, and we're surrounding it with different symbols, and gradually, through our process of meditation and self-education, those symbols become more and more significant, and they'll all lead us into the central one of the blue sky. So this is the mandala. And Tara Karunia loves making mandalas. We've got one of her mandalas up here. you'll see the fourfold or eightfold, the square with a dot in the middle. And we've had others around as well that you might have seen. Here's a more traditional Tibetan mandala up here with a Buddha in the center, surrounded by devotees and surrounded by the walls of a palace with gates at each in each direction and a keeper looking after the gates. And then because this is the mandala of the medicine Buddha, then that's surrounded by all the medicinal herbs that a doctor would need to learn about in traditional Tibetan medicine. So you're starting to get a sense of a mandala is a circle, but it becomes more than a circle. It becomes a circle with four compass points around the centre in particular, yeah? And four regions around it. And often these regions are coloured and all sorts of things like that. And probably you've come across the famous... Does anyone know what this mandala is made of before I say it?
Sand.
Sand, that's right. So isn't that incredible? You know, making something like that out of little grains of sand. And he's got the sand in this tube, and this tube is serrated, and he runs the piece of metal over the serrations, which make the tube slightly rattle. So the sand grains, just sort of in a very controlled way, the sand grains come out of the tube. And he puts the right colour in there. He's doing the blue of these little clouds here. Fantastic, really. And of course, what happens at the end is the whole thing is just tipped up and all just tipped away. So you have this fantastic work of art, but then there's this strong emphasis on impermanence. Don't forget, we've created this wonderful thing, now we're just going to let it go completely. It's wonderful. Here's another one. So you have an emblem in the center, which I think this emblem is a vase. Oh, maybe it's a parasol, yeah, okay. You're probably right, a parasol, which is one of the emblems of sovereignty. So this was sort of your symbol in the middle, and you surround it with all sorts of other symbols. So just going back to the quote on the first one, which I didn't actually read out because you didn't see it, but to make a mandala is to take any prominent aspect of reality and surround it with beauty. So it's something anyone can do. You can do it, you know, you can do it yourself, you can do it with crayons, or with objects as well. You could make a mandala on your table. You get this table, put something in the middle, you know, it might be a little pebble that you found when you were on holiday that means something to you, and then you'd surround it with beauty, you know, and that would be making a mandala. It's great fun to do it. This one's a Waitara mandala, so here the figure in the middle representing enlightenment is a female Buddha called Waitara. See the stylized walls and gates of the palace around her. And at the very top are the five Buddhas. So the five Buddhas start to appear, but in this moment, they're not a mandala of the five Buddhas, they're just sort of presiding over the whole scene, because this is part of Vajrayana Buddhism. So another very elaborate mandala with many, many layers of walls and so on going into the middle.
That one's got script around it, isn't it, as well?
Yes, so it's got mantras in, I think it's called the Siddhi script, around the outside. This is four mandalas with different... Remember, these are mythical figures, and they represent aspects of enlightenment. And for some people like their Buddhism very austere, and they just say, look, forget about all this, we've got the Buddha's teachings, let's just sit down, meditate, and be aware. And that is fine, that is genuine Buddhism. All this stuff with all the symbols is not essential. But for some people, it seems to really make a difference if they have that richness, that intense richness of symbolism. And for some people, I think it really is helpful. Certainly for me, I found it really helpful. In fact, when I started doing visualization meditations, I thought this is a bit silly. You know, I've got years to go with my mindfulness of breathing and my metta bhavana. But actually, it did introduce another element, which was quite unexpected to me. That sense of looking at a human figure who represented enlightenment. And it seemed to me, there was sort of my heart sort of responded somehow in a new way to that. And every figure, all these figures will have their own mandalas. They'll be surrounded, they become important, they're surrounded by other figures. And I'll just mention briefly, we have three rings of protection round every standard mandala. So these are lotus petals, yeah, and then vajras, a ring of vajras, and then finally a ring of flames. And when we do a dedication ceremony, if you've done one of those, you'll know that we try and create a mandala of our own meditation space and say, may the lotus petals of purity open around this mandala. May the vajra wall of determination extend around this mandala. May the flames that transmute samsara, the ordinary world, into nirvana, the enlightened world, arise around this mandala. So you can be you are in a way the center of a mandala. You are supremely important. You deserve to be surrounded by beauty. So as you sit in meditation, you can feel that you're surrounded by these rings of protection, the lotuses, the vajras, and the flames. So I want to go back a bit now to see how the five Buddha mandala in particular evolved. And what you'll often find if you look at early Buddha images and contemporary ones as well, is that the Buddha himself is being depicted, and it's an attempt in a way to represent the Buddha as a wanderer in India, you know, with his robes and his begging bowl and all that kind of thing. And you can see the tree, the Bodhi tree around him. So this is a historical Buddha, this is not a mythical Buddha. And very often he'd be flanked by two disciples. So on either side there would be two disciples, both in the stories about him and in the images that were made. So we already have more going on than just the Buddha. We have the Buddha with flanking figures on either side, yes? And here's another example, a Tibetan example, of two disciples sitting on either, standing on either side of the Buddha. And what this evolved into eventually was the five Buddhas. And I can't show you the intermediate steps really, because they don't appear in Buddhist history. So
it's medieval Earth, especially the first image you get looks medieval Earth than
yes.
Ancient India.
Oh yes, it is, yes. So this one here is Chinese. And it's the one that we have downstairs.
Who are those little figures at the bottom?
So those are musicians playing a little bit of a band. You know, the Buddha likes a bit of music, a bit of a party. And I think there's a table here with incense burning. Yeah. Does look a bit noisy, doesn't it? But I'm sure he didn't mind. But yes, so these, I haven't given you figures. So there are figures that I could have given you from early Buddhism that also show that from the very earliest Buddhist art, you'll often see the Buddha flanked by two disciples on either side, or sometimes by two deities on either side. And one of these is very often Vajrapani in the form of Hercules. So early Buddhist art was Greek influenced. I showed you this in the previous lecture. And you'll see one of the protectors who looks like the Greek god Hercules, or the Greek hero Hercules, but holding a Vajra, primitive form of the Vajra. And the one on the other side is often based on Dionysus. So you've got the two flanking figures. So when people started trying to represent not just the Rupakaya, the historical Buddha, but also the Dharmakaya, the mythic, emblematic, symbolic Buddha, they also often put figures on either side of him. Often it would be two bodhisattvas. So they'd show two mythic bodhisattva figures on either side of the central Buddha. And that central Buddha, there could be loads of them. There could be many, many possibilities. And the sutras, the early Mahayana sutras, were often devoted to different Buddha figures. They would appear in them. So one of the very early, very popular ones, which is still the most popular of all these figures, was the red Buddha of the West, Amitabha. And so Amitabha would be flanked by two bodhisattvas, the one called Great Strength on one side, and the one called Avalokiteshvara, the Compassion Bodhisattva on the other side. Those would be there on either side of that Buddha. But after a while, you also sometimes get three Buddhas in a row, a central Buddha and a Buddha representing the directions. So there you'd have the central Buddha being the Buddha associated with the sun. Remember, we're talking about mythical figures now. So the sun Buddha, called the illuminator, Virochana. Don't try and remember all this. There's a huge amount of information in all of this. And just take in what is of interest to you, and I'll just tell you what to read if you want to know more about it. So you've got the Sun Buddha, Virochana, in the middle, flanked by the Buddha of the West on the western side, the Red Buddha, and the Buddha of the East on the eastern side, the Blue Buddha, and the Sun Buddha in the middle being white. The central figure is normally white in the mandala. So you've got that, and this goes on for a while, and then later on, as the Vajrayana emerges, you get two more in the north and the south, and then you get the complete mandala has appeared now. And this mandala consists, therefore, of these five Buddhas. So sometimes you'll just see them sitting in a row. So I'll show you this first. So we've got the white Buddha in the middle, which is the Sun Buddha, Virochana. We've got the red Buddha of the west. We've got the green Buddha of the north, the yellow Buddha of the south, the blue Buddha of the east. And these two Tibetan versions of are quite similar, as you can see. Wearing rich robes, but yet monastic robes. Sometimes you'll see Buddhas or Bodhisattvas dressed as princes, but in this case not, they're dressed as monks, but in rich robes. And here again you'll see the five Buddhas again in a row at the top of the mandala, a mandala of Vajrasattva in this case. If you're very sharp, you'll notice these ones are in a different order. And in the, so it's not a very good picture, so I just wanted to, I found this online, and it sort of gives you a sense of the arrangement of the five Buddhas. So in a sense, the central Buddha, the Sun Buddha, is sort of on a slightly different level. That's the Buddha of reality itself, the sort of the central Buddha, the aspect of reality that is prominent, that you're going to surround with beauty. So you surround it with these four figures. So one thing that is often a bit confusing for people is that the Eastern, the Blue Buddha of the East, is right in front of you. So this is not the same way that you hold your A to Z map of London, where you have the South at the bottom and the North at the top. In a mandala, you have the East at the bottom and the West at the top, or the East nearest to you and the West furthest from you. And it might be, if you're very clever, you might be able to work out why this should be the case. There is a reason for it. Come back to that at the end if you're interested. So we've got the Buddha of the Blue Buddha of the East, the Yellow Buddha of the South, the Red Buddha of the West, the Green Buddha of the North. And in the centre, we've got the White Buddha of the centre. And here's another one. In this case, each of the Buddhas has a Bodhisattva with them. They don't have their different colours, but they still are. We've still got the Virochana in the centre. This is...
Actually, it's the different way around, isn't it?
Yes,
it
actually, looks
like Amitabha at the bottom.
Yeah, it looks like Amitabha at the bottom in this case. It's just to deny what I just said. And maybe the reason for this is because this, I think, is Japanese, and the Japanese do things differently sometimes. Just see if that's the case here, because this is another Japanese one, and this is one of the main in Japan. What's called in Tibet the Vajrayana is called the Shingon, and it's the so-called esoteric form of Buddhism. And they also use vajras and mandalas and the transformation of your energies, all that kind of thing is very central there in the Japanese form as well. And they have two main mandalas, and one of them is called the Diamond Mandala, and the Diamond Mandala includes the five Buddhas. The Sun Buddha, Virochana in the centre, who becomes the most important Buddha in the Shingon school in Japan, and the other Buddhas, as usual, around them. And I think in this case, it probably is the right, in the right order, even though the colours vary a bit. So the Vajrayana never quite works. It's never quite consistent. It always takes you slightly by surprise if you say, this is always going to be like this. But in this case, you'll find that you've also got the emblems of the Buddhas around. These are jewels. This is a Vajra. This is a Vajra here. This, I think, is a... I'm not sure what that is. And this is a double Vajra. And this gives you the Japanese names of the five Buddhas, in case you want those on the same mandala. Dainichi Nyorai is the most famous one. But you've got Amida, the Buddha of the West. And here's a couple of Tibetan versions of the mandala of the five Buddhas. The white Buddha in the middle, blue Buddha in the east, yellow Buddha in the south, red Buddha in the west, green Buddha in the north. So that's the mandala of the Buddhas, the arrangement of that. And later on, I'm going to give you some of the symbolism, some of the associations, because the great thing about Vajrayana symbolism is everything goes into it. Everything goes into a five-fold arrangement. And in that five-fold arrangement, you'll see everything corresponds with everything else. And again, this, for some people, this may just be, what's all this about, you know, but for some people it can be really helpful. It's as if by becoming familiar with a particular Buddha, you become familiar with what's known as a family. Each Buddha, like here's the Buddha of the East, Akshobhya, and he's got a family called the Vajra family, which means lots of other Buddhist figures, including historical figures associated with that family, but also different emblems, different aspects of the Buddhist path, different virtues and qualities, different problems and poisons, all that kind of, all, you know, associated particularly with Akshobhya. So by getting to know Akshobhya, you learn about these things and how they relate to each other. And you learn how, what can balance them as well by looking, say, at the Buddha of the balancing Buddha of the West.
And this, the similarity to Shiva images is really striking, at least to me.
Yeah.
In Shiva images, you typically also this, see the sickle moon and this just bluish kind of appearance.
Yes, Shiva is normally blue, that's right, yes. And the blue Buddha of the East is similar in that way. And in fact, Buddhist and Hindu art develop very much in parallel in India, and there's a lot of overlap between the two, including in the symbolism. And you might see it in some of the other things as well. And here's another... gradually, as we look at these, there's plenty of time to go into this, but you'll start to see the common associations. So with Akshobhya, this is the name of the Buddha. His name means the imperturbable. And he's the blue Buddha of the East. And he's associated with the Vajra family. So you'll always see Vajras, or usually see Vajras associated with him. His throne is supported by elephants. You know, that's the immovable. You can see the connection there, perhaps. And the gesture, each of the Buddhas has their own special hand gesture. And normally, Akshobhya's is in the earth-touching gesture. So he's associated with, yeah, that sense of being in touch with the earth. His element is water, and so on and so on. I'll show you some of these associations later. And here's a bronze statue of Akshobhya. And then the next one, going round, so we start at the east, we go around to the south. The next one is called Ratnasambhava, the jewel-born. So he holds a jewel in his hand. His gesture is the gesture of giving. And we'll see in the next thing, his throne is supported by horses. And here's a bronze statue of Ratnasambhava. And another one, this is a beautiful one, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And then we go to the west, Amitabha. Amitabha means infinite light. It's the red Buddha, associated with the setting sun, as you can see in this image. And also connected with him is Amitayus, which means infinite life. Very similar figure, also red, but holding the vase of immortality in his hands. There's another. This is our one from downstairs. So if you want to have a look at a figure of the Buddha of the West, then you can have a look at that one downstairs. And his throne is supported by peacocks, and his hands are in the mudra of meditation, a gesture of meditation. And then in the north, we've got Amoghasiddhi, City, a green Buddha, and his gesture is the gesture of fearlessness, and his emblem is the double Vajra that he holds in his hand. And rather mysteriously, his throne is supported by shanshangs. And I don't know very, I don't know anyone here knows much about shanshangs, but they are weird. because they're half bird, half human, and they clash symbols. They rush around clashing symbols, and definitely.
They're a bit like sphinxes,
aren't they? It might be Shang Shang, the symbols, yeah, like sphinxes, yeah. And interestingly, one of the other names for Omega City, this might be something Neil doesn't know, I always try to put something in that Neil doesn't know, is Dundubishvara. In the Sutra of Golden Light, Omega City is known as Dundubishvara. And the word Dundubi, or Dunduba, means a drum. So Dundubishvara means the Lord of the Drum. So he's definitely, you know, definitely the most rock band sort of Buddha, this one. So he's the Lord of the Drum, and his supporters are clashing cymbals. And the double vajra, of course, is a symbol of infinite energies meeting together, combining together from all directions. So yes, Shangshang, they fly through the air as well. He's very much associated with the element of air. And they carry his throne, sort of zooming above the northern forests, and with that colour of the pine tree. And Fritz mentioned the moon, the sickle moon, but normally these figures will have a moon and a sun above them, sun and a moon. So there he is. So this is the sort of the rock star Buddha, I suppose, this one. And there's a bronze statue of Omega City. Well, Omega City means infallible success. And this is a figure of Omega City with a female Buddha in sexual union. So this is another feature of Vajrayana Buddhism, is the use of, because everything's brought in, especially sex, because sex is such a strong thing, isn't it? It's such a big part of a lot of people's lives. So you have a sexual symbolism of the complete union of the masculine and feminine aspects of each of the Buddhas. So quite often, if you find emblems of the jhanas or even the whole mandala, you'll see that they are not just alone. They're in union with the female equivalents. And in this case, in the case of Omega City, the female Buddha associated with Omega City is Green Tara. So this is Green Tara and Omega City. It's very difficult to find, apart from these yabhyomas, they're called sexual images, it's very, very difficult to find images of most of the female Buddhas by themselves. They didn't have the same prominence, apart from Green Tara. Green Tara is the exception. You'll find lots and lots of images of Green Tara. Actually, I meant to put one in the slideshow, but I forgot.
And White Tara?
White Tara is sometimes associated with Virochana in the middle of the mandala as a female Buddha, yeah. But
White Tara's got Amitabha in the crest of her.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. But she's sometimes just said to be the consort of Virochana. Maybe because she's white. I'm not sure. But normally the other four normal female Buddhas are not depicted. You very rarely see them.
You very rarely hear about them.
You don't very often hear about them either, do you?
The Vinci cause.
Yes, it's one of those secrets, one of those secret esoteric things that you have to be very clever to hear about. In fact, there are pujas. They've become very popular in the Tri Ratna Buddhist order. And there are pujas that have been written for them, and people are starting to paint them more and more. That's right, isn't it? Have you done any paintings of female Buddhas? So Tara Kruni's done some paintings of female Buddhas, for example. So they are, it is starting to happen.
It's a big set
of crystal. That's right, isn't it? Yeah, yes, I wish I had some. I did have a look online and couldn't get any images. But the Bristol ones, I'll hunt down. If I give the slideshow again, I'll make sure the female Buddhas are properly included. I'll just mention their names, because in Vajrayana, being a magical, alchemical system, the name is always really important, so the name gives you a clue to the figure. So if you remember, the central Buddha, Virochana, is known as the Illuminator, and his female Buddha, the female Buddha associated with him, is usually known as Akashatarteshvari, which means the queen of luminous space, or the queen of infinite space. Akasha means the space of awareness. So she's the queen of awareness, of the space of awareness. And it's said that Virochana represents the rays of the sun, and she represents the space through which the rays pass, if that makes any sense. Or you could say that Virochana represents the center of awareness in your life, and Akasha Tateshwari, the female Buddha, represents the space in which that awareness happens. So then if we go to Akshobhya, see if I can remember these figures actually. So I think Akshobhya's female Buddha is Lochinar, is that right? So Lochinar means she with the eye. And Akshobhya is associated very much with the mirror-like wisdom, with the wisdom which is simply open to the way things actually are. And Lochinar is in a way in a more active aspect of that. She's the one with an open eye that is really fascinated, really interested in everything. And then Ratnasambhava, what's the name of his?
Malmiki.
Malmiki, that's right. So Malmiki means mind maker. So she who makes everything her own. So Ratnasambhava, the Buddha of the South, is associated with the wisdom of equality that recognizes the value of everything. And so Malmiki is participating in that same process. Malmiki, she makes everything her own. She loves everything as if it was her own son or daughter. And then you've got the Red Buddha of the West. And his consort, or the Buddha associated with him, is called Pandaravasini, which means, Pandara means white. So Pandaravasini means she who is arrayed in white. So he's the Buddha of the sunset, and she's the Buddha of this pure moon-like radiance, I suppose you could call it. And then we've already seen in Amoghasiddhi in the north, his consort is Green Tara. Tara means star, or she who ferries across. And she's very strongly associated with active compassion. And he's also a Buddha of active wisdom. So those are the female Buddhas. And there is a list of them that will come up later on the slides if you want to memorize this for your exams later. And then Virochana is the last one. So Virochana is shown holding, usually his hands are in the gesture of teaching, and he's holding or has on his throne the teaching wheel, the Dharma wheel or Dharma chakra. And his throne is supported by lions. And I mentioned that the Buddha, the female Buddha associated with him is the queen of infinite space, the queen of the space of awareness. And here's a statue of Virochana. And here's Virochana with the female Buddha. I put a question mark after Akasha Dateshwari because sometimes the name of his female Buddha is something different, and I wouldn't like to swear that this emblem is actually Akasha Dateshwari. Sometimes she has another name.
We've got a yup-yup figure down there.
Yes. Yeah, this is actually not one of the Jinnas though. This is what's called an Adi Buddha. But yes, if you want, you can see. So this is a male and female Buddha in sexual union. It's just showing that complete unity of these different energies, I suppose you could say. And it's regarded with great veneration in Tibetan Buddhism. It's not regarded. It's not something you put in the tabloid newspaper or something. It's something that is regarded as highly symbolic, very symbolic significance. By the way, I don't know if you noticed something strange about Virochana in this. Yeah, so actually he has, you can't see them all, but he has four faces in this one, and quite often, because Virochana is at the centre, he's actually shown with four faces, which is very weird to us maybe. And again, his consort here is shown with six arms. And I think he's got four arms. No, maybe he's got six arms as well. There you go. Yes. And on the soles of his feet are the Dharma wheels.
So what are all the arms?
To tell you the truth, I don't really know. You get this in Hinduism as well, multiple arms. And it seems to be partly a Buddha who's a bit like a Swiss Army knife, where you can open a lot of emblems. You know, so they can do lots of different things. And very often the different arms are holding different implements, like a Swiss Army knife. So it's a little bit like, it just means that they can do more. You know, you say, I haven't got enough arms to do all the work I've got to do. If only I had six arms, I could do it all. So that seems to be something like that, but I may be wrong in that. I don't really know. Has anyone else got any ideas?
No, that's a good explanation.
So what
kind of
these mentioned
manifold
forms
are
these faces for?
Well, they're because he's at the centre, it means he's looking in all directions, so his awareness is an all-round awareness. That seems to be the symbol of the four faces on Virajana. So, now, I don't know how you're going to find all this stuff. I found these actually online, these tables. I didn't have to draw them all out myself. And they call them the Dhyani Buddhas here, which is an old-fashioned word for them. It's not really correct, actually. Usually they should be called the five Buddhas or the five Jinnas, which means the five conquerors. So here are the five of them: Virajana, Akshobhya, Ratnasambhava, Amitabha, Amoghasiddhi, with the colours to remind you of that. And maybe this is the most important set of correspondences, really. And I mentioned it 2 weeks ago in the Vajra lecture. And this is the thing of the possibility of transforming certain problematic tendencies that we have, negative tendencies, poisons in fact, into aspects of the enlightened mind. So in the case of, we work from the bottom maybe, so Amoghasiddhi is associated particularly with jealousy or envy, and that can be transformed into the all-accomplishing or the all-performing wisdom. And if you, it may be that you can start to see the correspondences, and maybe you can start to get a sense of that. Now why should it, what's it like when I'm feeling a lot of jealousy, when I'm feeling a lot of envy? It's somehow as if I am wanting the qualities that some other people have. I feel impotent, in a way, in myself. I feel I need to borrow them from others. So if I can develop this incredible sense of courage and self-confidence, the ability to do anything, then I'll have that all-accomplishing wisdom. And the energy of jealousy can be turned around. It's got a huge amount of energy in it, you know. You can really do a lot of damage through jealousy. So it's not as if it's sort of a very weak thing, but the strength of it can be turned into a very, very helpful and creative wisdom. And then Amitabha is associated with desire or lust or craving. So when you have that intense craving, you've got an intense obsession maybe with one particular person or with one particular latte. Starbucks. So that intense focus on one thing as being really special, really important to you, that can be transformed into the discriminating wisdom, where you become fascinated in the special qualities that everything in your experience has. And instead of the lust for one thing, it becomes a fascination with everything.
I've not heard that explanation before. Is that one of yours or someone?
Well, maybe you have another. I mean, in a way, the explanation
really
is one's own, you know, but...
I haven't worked that one out.
No, I think that's the way that one goes, yes.
It does make sense.
Ratnasambhava is associated with pride. He says miserliness here, maybe I haven't heard that one before, but that sort of fits in another sense. So Ratnasambhava is associated with pride. So pride is when you think, rather than being obsessed with another person, it's you that is really important. So you feel, I am really important. And the wisdom that comes in there is where you feel that everybody's really important. So the wisdom of equality is where you think that people are, you know, everybody really matters, in a sense, in an equal sense, you know. So you've transformed your pride, your obsession with yourself, into, in a sense, an obsession with everybody, in a positive way. Akshobhya is associated with anger or hatred, and the anger or hatred is quite a cold and analytical thing, and it's sort of really cutting, and it's something that really sort of wants to break through. So it's got a Vajra sort of quality to it. So this can transform into the mirror-like wisdom that just sort of displays things exactly as there are, as they are, with no personal involvement in a sense, and just says, this is the way things are. I'm just going to let it be like that in a Vajra-like way, in a very... forceful way, I suppose you could say. And then Virajana, in a way, is the whole lot. Being the central figure on slightly on a different level, represents the transformation of ignorance into the complete openness of the Dharma Dhatu wisdom, the all-encompassing. That's misspelled by the term extra agent. So it's the wisdom of the sphere of reality. The Dharma Dhatu means the sphere of reality. So it sees everything. It encompasses everything. Instead of having that blindness of ignorance, you transform that into its opposite. So has anyone got any specific questions about it? Is it helpful? And I'm going to go through some more correspondences, but you know, sometimes it can seem very complicated, but you may find that you can pick things out of it that are actually useful to you.
If White Tara is a consort of Arjuna, maybe she is sort of the actual aspect of seeing because of all her eyes.
Yeah.
That's one of the things about her, isn't it?
So White Tara is very associated with amazing awareness because she has eyes in the palms of her hands and in the palms of her feet. So you've got that sense of just being very, very there, very aware.
But also a sort of acceptance as well. So it's
yes.
That's what occurs with that.
Yeah, it's good thinking. Yeah.
What do you mean by mirror-like wisdom? So with anger.
Well, I think the mirror-like wisdom means if you look at a good mirror, the mirror just displays whatever is put in front of it. It doesn't interpret it. It doesn't have its own ideas about it. It doesn't have its own ideology. You just put the mirror up, it's there. It doesn't mind whether you put sort of a lump of shit in front of it or whether you put some beautiful flower in front of it. It makes no difference. The Buddha just displays what is there. So
it
similarly,
reverses everything as well.
It reverses, maybe reverses everything, yes. So what do you think, is there any connection between that? Can anyone else think between that and anger?
Anger is a determination to see things in a distorted and perverted way, isn't it, really, if you look at it?
Yeah.
Well, that applies to all of them. I think the thing is with anger in particular is that if you put something that anger doesn't like in front of it, it wishes to destroy it. You know, but it needs to become the mirror of wisdom because whatever you put in front of the mirror, it will not.
So the mirror allows it to be as it is. It doesn't insist that it's got to be different or go away, which is what anger is like.
Which is what anger is like. Yeah.
Anger is saying, if you or don't change, I'm going to go for you, mate, you know, or I just want you to get out of my sight.
You'll be the one to blame.
I'm thinking more that anger, you know, like there's that thing about if you throw fire, you get burnt in the process. Anger is actually directed at you just as much as doing it.
So in a way the mirror throws the anger back at you, you could say. You have to feel it. And I think there's a lot of truth in that.
Whatever it's reflecting.
I mean, the thing is there isn't any right or wrong way of looking at these. It is it's first on finding connection which works.
And there are so many connections here that you're bound to find something that works for you. And some of it just won't make sense, you know. But there's plenty of them.
So someone's described jealousy to me as thinking that someone else has got something that belongs to you.
Or that ought to belong to you.
No. Yes, well, I suppose that, yeah. The most extreme form of it is that someone else has got something of mine.
Yes.
But I can't get it.
So what's the connection with the all accomplishing
wisdom?
Well,
you said that, you know, if you... I'm not sure, really, but...
You realise you can have it.
You can have because it's achieving. It can achieve anything in a way. It doesn't need to look outside for its needs. I suppose it can do it. It's a doing thing. It's saying, okay, something missing. I'll go and deal with that.
But it doesn't have to be the particular thing about jealousy. Is it's very it's like anger, isn't it? It's honed in on a particular thing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So maybe all accomplishing is, you know, rather than just one thing, it can be anything.
Yeah. So somehow you have to see if you can get a feel for the energy that's present in these poisons and see if you can, rather than denying that energy, seeing if you just turn it in a very subtle way so that, you know, the energy of desire becomes this sense of fascination with everything, you know, rather than just saying, oh no, that's very naughty, I'm going to squash it down. And that's the Vajrayana approach.
You can't accomplish the enlightened mind until you've transformed. So when you feel fear, you're crippled. You can't really accomplish anything.
That's right. Yes.
So
if you
feel hatred, you can't see.
Yeah. Yes.
So the connection is that which it transforms into its, not its opposite, but its connected achievement or ability.
Yes, that's right. So there's a connection with that particular achievement or that ability or that universal quality that comes out of something which is a human thing, the human tendency to feel hatred or craving or love. Here are some more connections. There are even sort of medical connections with the five jhanas. But particularly interesting, I think, are the elements and the senses. And as you learn about them, they can sort of make sense of some of the other correspondences as well. Moga City is associated with the element of air, and there's that sense of huge freedom of being carried by the cymbal clashing shanshan birds through the air over the forests, free to move in any direction. Amitabha with fire, so fire is, you know, in a way connected with craving, which is his poison, but also connected perhaps with the discriminating wisdom, because it's by fire that you can get the metals, the precious metals, out of their ores. Any thoughts about any of these?
Is there any books that have all this?
Yes. Just trying to remember if this has a table in it. There's a book called Meeting the Buddhas, which has a complete table of all this stuff in it. But there's also a book by Vasantra called A Guide to the Buddhas, which has this material in it, and a smaller one just on the mandala of the five Buddhas here.
Guide to the Buddhas Path, was it?
Yeah, but this has a table in the back, this little one of the correspondences. Or if you want to make a mental note of this website, viewonbuddhism.org. If you look at viewonbuddhism.org, it's got some, and I think he's taken some of these from Meeting the Buddhas, from the book. Here's some more. So this is the other beings associated with them. So the meaning of their name, the name of the female Buddha associated with them. Each of them has a bodhisattva. Some have more than one bodhisattva. This is the special bodhisattva. The bodhisattva, if you like, the enlightenment in process, the active, and Buddha as enlightenment, as present, as there. And this last list means, at least according to Buddhist myth, what you might call Buddhist mythical history, the actual Buddhas who appeared in the different eras of world history associated with each one, because according to Buddhist, I'd say legends, but you know, maybe it's true, there are many Buddhas. Every age has its own Buddhas appearing. So the Buddha is the one who rediscovers the Dharma in any particular age. And our Buddha is called Shakyamuni, the sage of the Shakyas. But many thousands of years before him, before Buddhism was forgotten by a previous age of people, there was another Buddha called Kashyapa. And before that, one called Karakamuni, one before that, Krakachanda. And then in the future, there will be, when Buddhism is forgotten, if we don't keep going with it and we just stop practicing, Buddhism will eventually be forgotten and somebody will have to rediscover it from scratch. And that person will be called Maitreya, the loving one. So each of these are associated with the jhanas as well. Some more? And there are many more. So yes, the colours of them, the directions we talked about, and the mudra, the gesture that each one has. Turning the Dharma wheel, or teaching, touching the earth, the giving, meditation, and fearlessness. So it's a whole world you can enter. And remember, each of the Buddha has a family, in a sense. And so what what you may find, if you do start to take this seriously, is you'll feel a favourite. You'll feel there's one of the Buddhas, or one of the types of Buddha family, that really appeals to me. You might sort of feel, yes, I love that setting sun energy of Amitabha, that rich redness of Amitabha, I love that. The sense of stillness in deep meditation, of withdrawing from the senses and going into meditation, which is associated with Amitabha. The sense of internal illumination, infinite light. So it might be that Amitabha becomes your favourite. And so that means you would be in the Padma family, the Lotus family, which is Amitabha's family. And you might start learning about the different figures in that family. That might be your sort of speciality. You might start learning the mantras, the Amitabha mantra, Om Namah Devaya Namah Hrih, and so on. You know. Or it could be one of the other ones that really appeals to you. But maybe not. You know, maybe the Vajrayana is not your bag, really. Maybe you prefer a simpler Buddhism of just being aware, just being there with your experience, and the richness of the symbolism actually doesn't help you. And I think that is fine. So these are the names of the families, the Buddha families. The Wheel family, the Vajra family, the Jewel family, the Lotus family, and the Double Vajra or Vishvajra family. These are the seed syllables, which you'll find in their mantras, which people will learn to draw in Sanskrit or in the different Tibetan scripts. If you like calligraphy, they'll do that sort of thing. The vehicle, the supporter of the throne, a lion for Virajna, an elephant for Akshobhya, a horse for Asambhava, peacock for Amitabha, and the Shangshan or the Garuda, which is a similar. The Garuda is a sort of an eagle-like bird. Actually, these ones on the website were slightly different, so I've changed them to what I understand to be the standard animals. And then also each one is associated with a particular aspect of the way you experience the world. So form is the external world, consciousness is your awareness, sensation is, I should say Vedana, not Vendana, which sensation or feeling, which is the quality of your experience, what the flavour it has. Perception, which is the way you recognise things. And impulses, which are the habit energies, the volitions, the tendencies and directions that your mind has. So this is a standard list in Buddhism of five aspects of the personality. And these also are associated with the different Buddhas as well.